Illinois could be a day away from its first full state budget in years and avoid a credit downgrade to junk status. That's if legislators in the House vote to override Governor Rauner's veto. Representative Lou Lang is a Democrat from the Chicago suburbs.
We're almost there, and the rating agencies are watching. They've already made a comment or two that they see good progress.
Democrats call it long overdue. Rauner and many Republicans blast it as a damaging tax hike. Where does the budget stand now? And what's at stake for the people hurt by the standoff and the political leaders on either side of the latest budget proposals? Plus, a hostage situation that took place at an Illinois hospital earlier this year has raised the question, is enough being done to keep medical staff safe? And we look at what it would take to build a high-speed rail from O'Hare to downtown Chicago.
It is also important for the public to have a good opinion about what it is that is being invested in for them.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline in for Nyla Boodoo today. It's 735 days since Illinois last had a state budget, and after a showdown in the State House on the 4th of July, today could be the last before a new budget is enacted. State senators, led by majority Democrats, volleyed with Governor Rauner yesterday, first passing a series of budget bills and then overriding the governor's promised veto. That sends the spending and tax hike proposals back to the House, led by Democratic Speaker Michael Madigan. Legislators there plan to meet again tomorrow around midday and could override the governor's veto. But as of now, still no budget. There's obviously a lot at stake for agencies that offer services like mental health and addiction support, shelters for the homeless and survivors of domestic violence and rape, among the many other groups and universities we've heard from in the past 2 years. There's also a lot at stake for Governor Rauner, Speaker Madigan, and the politicians on either side of this budget standoff. We'll talk more about political stakes and calculations in a few minutes. But first, we're joined by Wendy DeBoe. She's the CEO of United Way of Metropolitan Chicago. Wendy, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian. Great to talk to you.
We could either have a budget tomorrow or be stuck in the same place that we've been for the last 2+ years. What's at stake here for you and the work you do with United Way?
Well, you know, there's a lot at stake for what's going on in the human services world, not just for United Way, but for the agency service partners that actually reach people with services. And we are encouraged by what we saw go on over the past couple of days. We think it is showing leadership and courage, you know, that both parties, we've got some bipartisan support coming together and compromising to reach a budget. It's critical that they do, in fact, get to a full and comprehensive budget. We think that this is critical for the human services world. You know, we've reported for the past several years how the unpredictability of not having a budget, the backlog of bills that have not been paid, that's been mounting, that, as you know, has reached to be about $15 billion at this point, is really, really harmful for human service agencies in the state of the sector. So we are pleased by the momentum that we see here, and we hope it continues. We hope we get that budget secured by tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, Wendy, you've talked in the past about the damage that's been done to many of the groups that you work with. Is there any way to quantify how the budget crisis has affected the people that you serve and work with at United Way?
Yeah, and in fact, we actually have quantified this and have been putting out survey data for the past several years and continue to do so because we felt it's important to quantify. We documented that last year, without the budget, 1 million clients fell out of services. That is a variety of different kinds of human services that, of course, reach those that are most at risk and vulnerable residents of the state. We have also, in our latest survey, reported that about half of the agencies that we fund that are, you know, usually in very, very good standing have utilized their cash reserves. So they're pretty, you know, pretty depleted and on edge financially. And then we reported most recently that 25% of the agencies that we reach have completely closed programs, right? And so that's what's extremely scary. If there is no budget that's secured and the agencies continue to have to navigate through an environment that's so unpredictable, not sure of what money will come in from the state, if any at all, you'll see more you know, program closures. And, you know, what we see that's so risky about a situation without a budget is you can't, it's hard for the agencies just to come back and flip a switch and put programs back on and reach people that need the services. You've got to have a full and complete budget in place so there's predictability and agencies can keep people, can keep trained staff, can ramp up and deliver services the way they need to. Otherwise, it's very hard to look into the future and see a very stable climate that takes care of people in the state of Illinois.
Sure. Wendy, what's your message to lawmakers, particularly members of the Illinois House, that have to take another vote on this issue? Have you been in touch with them?
You know, we have. We've been in touch with them actually for many years on this now. My message is keep going. As I said before, we are encouraged by what we see, the compromise that has, you know, been taking place over the past couple of days across the aisles to get to the right answer, to get to a budget. We are encouraged. It takes courage. Keep going. We need this budget. The people of Illinois need this budget. The people, you know, most at risk in our state need this budget. So let's get it done, because the alternative, you know, is really, really scary, I think, for the people in our state.
And what's the mood like among your staff and the agencies you work with as they're watching this process here over the last several days?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the mood, you know, everybody is very tense and on edge, concerned. You know, we've been concerned for a long time. It's why we've been out speaking on this and doing survey research. You know, everybody's concerned. If we can get a budget, you know, we have a chance of moving into the future with stability and trying to get this on track. If we don't, I think, you know, the feeling is we're all sort of flapping in the wind again. And, you know, it's not good for the state of Illinois. Obviously, the rating agencies are waiting, you know, to have the you know, our credit downgraded. Would be terrible. It'd be terrible for people in the state. It'd be terrible for those relying on human services. It just digs us in deeper. So everybody is sort of, I would say, on edge, waiting and hoping that within a day we will have that budget, and that the, you know, the House will come back and do the right thing and vote on this, and we will have that full and complete budget that we haven't had in 2 years. I mean, that seems pretty unprecedented.
Yeah, it certainly is. Once there is a budget, whether that's tomorrow, next week, or further down the road, where do you start to repair and rebuild?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I think it starts with a really good understanding of, you know, how do you have enough funding in the state for human services that are essential to take care of people and make sure that we have a bright future, right? We've reported on this in many of our surveys. When, you know, funding is cut to early childhood resources or to access to health care or to after-school programs for at-risk youth or to job training programs, you're really robbing Illinois' future. And so I think, you know, in this whole mix, what has to happen is very, very smart investment with the resources that we have toward programs that really, really have strong returns for people into the future. And so, you know, you need bipartisan support for those things. It's really sort of taking a look and saying it's taking care of our people and taking care of our economy and taking care of our growth and taking care of our fiscal situation. And those things do not have to be diametrically opposed. There can be smart policies that do all of those things together, which is what we've been advocating for a long time. And our hope in the next day is that, you know, with this budget, there's sort of a balanced picture on resources that can try to, you know, there's some cuts that are proposed in order to achieve this budget. There's revenue increases, but that you can take a look at all of that and say, how do we invest? How do we invest in the human capital of our state? You know, obviously the universities are a great example of this too. You can't have a healthy and growing state if students won't be coming to our higher educational institutions. So it's that picture.
Wendy DeBow, the CEO of United Way of Metropolitan Chicago, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Always a privilege. Thank you.
And as we mentioned, there's still not a budget yet, and the political calculations and maneuvers continue to play out ahead of tomorrow's session in the Illinois House. Brian Mackey is Illinois Public Radio's State House reporter. He's on the line again from the Capitol. Brian, welcome back to the 21st.
Good to talk with you, Brian.
And Christopher Mooney directs the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. He joins us by phone today. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian, let's start with you. The Senate voted yesterday to override Governor Rauner's vetoes on the budget legislation. One of the questions we're hearing today, if this is such an urgent issue, why is the House waiting until tomorrow to attempt this override?
That's a good question. And the truthful answer is the House is made up of 118 different people who are all have the free will to do their own thing. The House tried to meet today, actually. I just, before coming on the show, I was just in the House chamber where they did the roll call for attendance and did not have a quorum. Personally, in 12 years covering the legislature, I can only remember that happening one time before, and that was yesterday, actually, when they called the roll call for attendance and didn't have a quorum yesterday. So there was all this buildup, the very dramatic vote on Sunday evening. It went over to the Senate. The Senate couldn't muster the votes on Monday. They called another day of session for July 4th. A senator who is battling a very serious illness, you know, came back to the building in order to, you know, give the final vote. A Republican crossed over the aisle to cast another critical vote. And there's all this buildup. The governor does his veto. The Senate overrides. And then the House just kind of fizzled out. And here we are waiting, hoping that the credit rating agencies don't, think that there's any, you know, sort of hiccup here and knock Illinois down to junk bond status.
Yeah, you mentioned the credit rating agencies, Brian. Could you just kind of bring us up to speed on the situation there?
Yeah, so Illinois has gone 2 years without. Where do you want me to start? Back in 1917, we created a pension system. So Illinois has not had a budget in 2 years. We've had a series of credit rating downgrades, and because we have had cash pressure, liquidity pressure, as they say in the parlance of Wall Street, Illinois has more autopilot spending through court orders and laws that say, you know, you have to make the pension payment automatically. State employees have been paid through a court order during this budget impasse. Payment to Medicaid providers has been ordered by courts. And in fact, there was a recent court ruling that was going to mandate that we start paying a lot more towards those providers. And in fact, we're not out of the woods in that situation yet. Illinois is literally running out of money for the things that it has to pay for by court order or law. And it hasn't even had a budget. So, fast forward, the credit rating agencies take a look at that and they say, you know, enough is enough. 2 years is enough. If you guys don't have a budget by the end of the fiscal year, June 30th, Illinois is going to be the first state ever rated junk bond status. They're a little more careful in their phraseology. I'm paraphrasing. So this was a big pressure point. It's something that a lot of people cited. And it's not just this idea that, you know, it's a black mark on the state's reputation, which it certainly is. But this can lead to something called a negative credit spiral. Illinois, in order to do its everyday business, has to borrow from the markets. And if that were the case, the people who could buy Illinois bonds would be severely limited. It would be limited basically to people who speculate and would demand premium payments for it. And suddenly, instead of getting, you know, 3-4% interest rate on our bonds, we might be paying 9% or who knows how high. We'd essentially have to go to the payday loan store, so to speak, for, you know, to keep Illinois government running. And that just leads to this spiral of wasted money. As one of the representatives said in the House debate, we might as well take $800 million, he was referring to the backlog of bills, but, you know, put that money on a pile on the floor and light it on fire, because it's not actually doing anything to advance the state. So I'm going on. I'll just say there was this big buildup, warnings from the credit rating agencies. Then after the House did vote for a balanced budget, right? It had spending cuts on the spending side. It had a higher personal income tax rate, 1.2 percentage points higher on the revenue side. The credit rating agency says, okay, we are pleased to see some forward progress here. We're going to withhold judgment while we see how this plays out. But you still have to finish the job and pass the budget.
Okay, Chris Mooney, let's bring you into this conversation. After 2+ years of this standoff, you know, with the governor demanding changes to areas like workers' compensation, property tax freeze, in exchange for a temporary tax hike, which could end up being permanent, you know, if this budget does go through, if the House does override the governor's veto, does Governor Rauner essentially walk away empty-handed in these proposals?
Well, it certainly looks like that at this point. There's not much coming out of there, the bills that they're working on now that is anything like his demands and this, you know, 44-point turnaround agenda that he came into office with. And that agenda has been pared and manipulated and shrunk and expanded and various changes over the last 2 years. But I think bottom line is he's getting almost nothing out of this that he wants, at least in terms of substance. On the other hand, I mean, from a political perspective, maybe this is the best thing for him because he can say, I fought a good fight, I fought these tax increases, they overrode me, it's the Democrats, blame them, oh, and then I get to spend this money and I get to start fixing the state up. Because right now, the governor is pretty much wearing a jacket for the fiscal destruction of the state, and this is a way of getting out of that. And so it looks like he may be able to get away from having to, you know, be the one responsible for all this without actually having to, you know, sign off on a tax increase. So he's in some sense having his cake and eat it too. Now the question is, how are you guys and the media gonna portray this? Are they going to allow that sort of narrative to occur, as opposed to, say, the counter-narrative that others, and not just Democrats, might come up with and say, look, somebody had to step up and do the responsible thing here before the whole state fell into a dark abyss.
Chris, I'm going to have to stop you here for just a second. We've got to take a quick break here, but we'll have a more time to talk about the implications politically and policy-wise on the potential House override vote tomorrow. That's coming up next. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering knowledge in its disciplines by recruiting and retaining library faculty, researchers, and thought leaders with deep subject matter knowledge and expert librarianship. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline in for Nyla Boodoo. Ahead of tomorrow's expected vote in the Illinois House to override Governor Rauner's veto on budget legislation, we're talking to Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House reporter, and Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Chris, before the break, you had mentioned kind of two possible things going on here. You got to one of them. What was item number two on that list?
Well, yeah, the first one was that it depends on how the media spins this thing and the story that they buy. And then, of course, the second one is which story do voters accept? Are the voters going to believe when the governor says, look, I fought the good fight, they're just a bunch of tax and spend liberals? Are they going to buy that and support him more than they've been supporting and potentially for reelection? Or are they going to buy the alternative scenario? And that, you know, we're just going to have to wait and see on that. It's going to play itself out in the 2018 gubernatorial election. Millions, tens and millions, over $100 million probably will be spent on exactly that second point, trying to convince people of these two alternative stories.
And Brian Mackey, let's talk a little bit about what's happening behind the scenes. You know, between yesterday's votes in the Senate to override and tomorrow's House session, is the governor working to pull Republican votes away from the bills? Is the speaker reaching out to hold some of the numbers needed to override? What are you seeing kind of behind the scenes at the State House right now?
Well, there's not been a lot of people here, but the Republicans, I talked to a couple of Republicans this morning who both voted for the tax increase, and, you know, the overall budget package. And they both say that the governor has not been in contact. Now, they say that's not unusual. The governor typically does work through the House Republican leader. But they say, well, they certainly have heard from a lot of constituents on both sides of the issue, as a matter of fact. One of those legislators is from here in the Springfield area. And she said that a lot of her constituents are actually thanking her, which you might expect in the city where state government is one of the biggest employers. But, you know, they said they have not heard from the governor's office. And I think that goes to the point, Chris, was making before the break, that in some ways this is a political win for the governor. He had the option when the veto, or I should say when the legislation came to him, the Constitution gives him 60 days. So if he, you know, had really, you know, wanted to, you know, Freedom Caucus style, like we've seen in Washington, sort of like throw a, you know, a real brick on this thing, he could have sat on the budget and demanded, no, send me a clean one, or, you know, send me something else, you know, an all cuts budget or something like that, which he has never really called for. And he chose not to do that. He cooperated by issuing the veto right away so that the Senate could come back in a matter of, frankly, less than an hour after the veto and override him. And from what I've heard so far, and I certainly haven't talked to everybody who voted yes, he is not working the roll call among the people that I've talked to try and convince them to change their minds, which, as I said, goes to the point Chris was making about this is politically about the best thing that could happen. You know, assuming that the House does override the governor's veto, Illinois has a budget, the state doesn't collapse, and he gets to campaign as the anti-tax guy and spend some of his vast fortune on advertisements and convincing people that it's House Speaker Michael Madigan who's the root of all evil and the higher tax rate that they're going to be paying.
And speaking of Michael Madigan, the Speaker of the Illinois House, you know, do you know, just from what he has said, you know, there was some speculation that he might sit on this and perhaps even be willing to let the bond agencies downgrade the state's credit to junk status and be able to hang that label on the governor. Do we know if the Speaker is really seeing an override as a positive outcome for him and for the state?
I mean, he is. That was, I think, a fear expressed, and you heard certainly Republicans concerned that that's what he was doing. But I think that in the past week or so, the evidence publicly we have is that he has gone in the opposite direction. He wrote letters to the credit rating agency asking them to withhold judgment because of positive movement, as he put it, towards a deal. And a day after that, sure enough, unexpectedly, the House jumped into the vote on the overall budget deal. And so he has also, you know, said that he intends to override it. There was some speculation that maybe he would hold back, but he was very clear about that. I think every time he has had an opportunity to be coy about that, he has been clear, which is not always a given. Sometimes the Speaker speaks ambiguously and you have to sort of interpret the tea leaves a little bit. On this point, he is, at least in his public statements and in his actions, he has been pretty clear that he is not heading for junk status. I mean, this is, I can understand, though. I mean, Illinois has had 2 years without a budget, and a lot of people have said, you know, you had a supermajority, you could have done something, you could have prevented the automatic tax cut that you know so hobbled state government finances a couple of years from going into effect, and he you know followed his members who were not ready to take that vote on their own at the time, you know, so to get to your back to your main question, no, I it does not seem publicly that he is courting junk bond status, and in fact I've just saw some reporting in the last few minutes that House members are being told that they should get back here for Thursday, but you know, we were also cautioned in the media that this thing is in flux. People have had deaths in the families. They had spent, I think, almost more than 2 weeks continuously in Springfield. People had to, you know, get back and, I don't know, water their houseplants or whatever they have to do in their hometowns, pay the rent. So, you know, it just has been a logistical challenge getting everyone back here.
Sure. Chris Mooney, back to you. We just have a couple minutes left here in this conversation. But, you know, how are the Democrats going to try and manage their message on this? You know, should they override this? Should the budget go into effect? And should the tax increase go into effect?
Well, I think their story is that they are acting in a responsible manner, that they saw a financial disaster for the state that was completely human-made, and that they were the ones that were willing to, you know, step up and do what needs to be done. And that's a hard thing because that involved both severe tax spending cuts, actually more spending cuts than the governor actually proposed, as well as raising taxes. And neither of those things are something that anybody likes, voters or politicians. But they, you know, they, I think the hue and cry from the rank and file, both on both sides, was so strong that both the Speaker and the Governor have now sort of, you know, as Brian was suggesting, sort of are going to get this done. And then, like I say, the Democrats are going to try to make the case that they, you know, along with, they're going to say it's a bipartisan thing because it was one Republican senator and something, what, 15, 10 Republican House members have voted on these things. So they'll make that case, and then they'll just hammer the governor till the end of time. I mean, they're going to hammer him hard on this, and, you know, we'll see how that works out for him.
All right. And before we wrap this up, Brian, in about 30 seconds or so, what are some signs you'll be looking for tomorrow as the day progresses as we approach that override vote?
I mean, I guess I'll be looking for cars in the parking lot, but really we're just going to wait until the House is scheduled to convene at 1:30, and, you know, we'll see if they have enough people here, who's here. People have indicated to us that nobody plans to change their vote. At this point, you've already done the damage to your political fortunes, if in fact you have done so. So we'll just, I guess it's just going to be a question of attendance and whether there's enough people here and whether they hang together.
Brian Mackey is Illinois Public Radio's State House reporter. Chris Mooney, the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Thanks to you both.
Good to talk with you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo today. When a prison inmate is in need of medical care, what precautions are taken to ensure medical staff are protected, and is it enough? Those questions have been on the minds of many in the medical community across Illinois since a hostage situation took place at Northwestern Medicine Delnor Hospital in the western Chicago suburb of Geneva this past May. An inmate who was receiving medical care stole a gun from a correctional officer and held a nurse hostage for several hours until he was shot to death by a SWAT team. In a few minutes, we'll speak with representatives from Illinois hospitals about how their medical teams are trained to respond in these types of situations. But first, I'm joined on the line by Hannah Leone, the crime reporter with the Aurora Beacon News, who's been following the issue at Delnor Hospital. Hannah, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What do we know about what happened on May 13th at Delnor Hospital?
Well, you already pretty much summed it up, you know, on May 13th, which was a Saturday. An inmate from the Kane County Jail who'd been receiving medical treatment at this hospital in Geneva was fatally shot at the end of a standoff that he essentially instigated by somehow getting a corrections officer's gun and then proceeding to take two nurses hostage over the course of several hours. This ended with the standoff with the regional SWAT team. And although negotiators did try to work something out with the inmates, ultimately an officer from the North Aurora Police Department who was on the team shot him in the head, and he was pronounced dead within minutes.
What had Taiwan Salters been brought to the hospital to receive treatment for?
So the sheriff's office has said that Taiwan Salters, who is this inmate, had been brought to the hospital because he had eaten a piece of plastic off of a gel-issued sandal. A lawsuit also alleges that he'd swallowed some type of cleaning solution.
Mm. How has the community responded to the news of this incident?
So definitely there's been a lot of support in the community for everyone who works at the hospital or who knows someone who was affected by what happened. Nurses at other hospitals have sent cards and gift baskets to show their support for both those who were directly affected by what happened that day and everyone who works at Delnor. Basically our columnist Denise Crosby has done a lot more looking at the community impact of this. And she told a story about twin sisters who are both nurses. One was in a Naperville emergency room as the hostage situation was going on at Delnor, where that nurse's sister was working at the time in Delnor's ER, and the sister in Naperville had recently taken part in an active shooter drill, and so, you know, was frantically texting her sister who was at Delnor while this was playing out. And in that way, people at, you know, other hospitals in the area were following this as it was happening.
In June, then, a lawsuit was filed by nurses at Del Norte, including the two who had been held hostage by the inmate. What's alleged in this lawsuit?
So, yeah, two nurses initially filed this lawsuit in June, and soon after, two additional nurses joined on to the suit. It basically alleges that even before the standoff, the hostage standoff occurred, that a nurse had previously discovered a corrections officer asleep on the couch in Taiwan Salter's room, that sheriff's officers had routinely unshackled him, and that on the morning of the hostage situation, that an unnamed officer had been sitting on a recliner using his laptop. And when the corrections officer, whose gun was stolen, started his shift, he allegedly, according to the lawsuit, removed Taiwan Salter's leg shackle so he could use the bathroom and just did not replace it. It also alleges that that officer, once he was disarmed, ran to a room down the hallway, shut the door, and hid instead of trying to help with the situation. And that while Salters then found his way into an office, he found a nurse there and took her hostage, made her take off her clothes, physically and verbally abused her, threatened her, and held her at gunpoint. It further alleges that when another nurse went into that office, that's when Taiwan Salters took her hostage as well. It's unclear exactly what happened inside of that room, but at some point, the second nurse convinced him to let her use the phone. And so she was in that way able to warn other hospital staff about what was happening. She also eventually led Taiwan Salters down to a first floor decontamination room. And I don't know if I said this before, this had all started on the third floor of the hospital, which is where Taiwan Salters had been kept. So the second nurse was somehow able to lead him down to a first floor decontamination room. And that's where he forced her to take off her clothes. And the lawsuit also alleges that he raped her, beat her, abused her, threatened her, told her she was going to die. The lawsuit alleges that once the SWAT officer shot Taiwan Salters, that that bullet also hit the nurse in her arm.
Okay. We'll talk more with you in just a minute, Hannah, but I'd like to bring two more people into the conversation. Chuck Plotner is the security director at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Chuck, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
And we also bring in Cindy Wrench. She is the she is with Edward Hospital in Naperville. She is the service line director there. Cindy, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Cindy, Northwestern Medicine Del Norte Hospital in Geneva is just 20 miles west of your facility in Naperville. How did your staff respond to the news of what happened this past May?
Well, interesting you should say that, because I was home and I was getting text paged because one of our nurses works at Del Norte as well. And so she was getting text pages as the whole thing was unfolding. So all of our staff was on high alert. I had notified the nursing supervisor, she was aware, legal was aware. I'd ask if Naperville police could do standbys and have increased visibility in the parking lots and by the entrances, because, you know, you never know. And I know that I had to go on Google. There was nothing on the news just to get updates and see what was going on. So it was a very frightening experience for everyone, and our hearts certainly were out going out to the nurses and the staff out Del Norte that day and since.
Sure. Oh, we'll talk about, you know, some of the conversations that have happened at your facility since then as well. But Chuck, let's bring you into this conversation. How are hospital staff in Carl's emergency department trained to handle a situation like this? If you could maybe in about a minute or so explain that for us.
Well, you know, it's really, you know, crucial to have those strong relationships between the hospital and law enforcement. Because we want to make sure that law enforcement knows the proper protocols and procedures when they bring a prisoner patient into our emergency department. Law enforcement is required to check in with security right at the emergency department, but when they enter, you know, security meets with that officer, lets them know our procedures and protocols. Our policy is that the prisoner patient has to be restrained at all times. The correction officer has to be present with the prisoner patient at all times. They have to be right there. And it's also important for medical staff to be observant. We want to make sure that if a medical staff member observes what they feel is an unsafe practice by a corrections officer or a police officer or a security officer, that they make sure that they report that so it can be followed up on.
Sure. We'll continue with that conversation here in just a moment. We're talking with Chuck Plotner, Security Director at Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana, Cindy Wrench, Service Line Director of Edward Hospital in Naperville, and also a reporter from Aurora as well. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. We're discussing a hostage situation that took place at Northwestern Medicine Delnor Hospital in the western Chicago suburb of Geneva this past May and its aftermath. We're talking with Hannah Leone, crime reporter for the Aurora Beacon News, Chuck Plotner, security director of Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana, and Cindy Wrench, service line director with emergency medicine and urgent care services at Edward Health in Naperville. Hannah, let's bring you back here in just a second, but first I want to mention that we did reach out to Delnor Hospital. They declined an interview on this topic, but did send along this statement saying, "The safety of our staff and patients is our highest priority. The professionalism and bravery demonstrated by our staff during the May 13th incident likely saved many lives. We're now focused on supporting our employees, implementing procedures to prevent this from happening again, and caring for the patients who trust us for their care." But Hannah, back to you. Initial reports from hospital officials after this incident stated that no one was hurt during the standoff. So are they denying the allegations made in the lawsuit?
I'm not sure if those initial reports were really, I know that the initial reports in the sheriff's office or the state's attorney's office, I'm saying that in a press conference, but the hospitals are pretty quiet about this, and they basically, in response to questions from me and some of my colleagues, have issued very, very similar statements, I think maybe even verbatim, what you just read, you know, basically said that there's pending litigation and there's an internal investigation that they're doing. And so at this time, they just want people to know that they do really care about the safety of their patients and their staff, and that they commend the actions of, you know, their employees who may have saved some lives that day.
Cindy, back to you. What kinds of conversations have taken place at your facility in Naperville since the incident at Delnor?
Well, prior to the incident, just in late April, we had a full-scale active shooter drill, which was extremely helpful. But we had been talking about this type of incident for the last 2 or 3 years even, and as well as 5 years ago, we had an active shooter drill at our Plainfield ED campus. So certainly it's at the top of our minds. But I would also say that it's not just prisoners and people under the custody of police that we have to be on high alert. We have to be high alert for all of our patients. Very unpredictable patient population. I think patients in general are escalated easier. I think there's a lot of anger in society these days, and we're trying to impart that we just want to keep our staff safe and work with our community partners and our public safety to make sure that we put things in place to do that.
Chuck, you mentioned, I think, before the break that part of the requirement there at Carle is that that any inmates who are admitted for health care are somehow shackled or detained in some way throughout. Is there any circumstance under which a prison mate would become unshackled at Carle?
Well, there have been a couple occasions where that has occurred. If there's an emergency, medical situation were to occur, where a provider says, we need to take the restraints off of this patient for a life-saving procedure, then we would have to do that. But what we would also need to do is make sure that we would have additional law enforcement officers present or additional security staff there present and to be there to safeguard the area. It's not what we want to do, but if we have to do that to treat the patient, then that's what we have to do.
Sure. And Cindy, similar guidelines in place there in Naperville?
Yes.
Okay. I'm curious, you know, since this incident occurred, you know, you talked about this as kind of an ongoing conversation that you've been having there. Have you identified any gaps in policies that you plan to fill in order to ensure that employees in the ER are safe there?
You know, we have a system place, house-wide violence, workplace violence task force, and we're always working. This is a non-evolving issue. I mean, it's never ending in terms of what we have to put in place. I wouldn't say that we have changed anything dramatically since that. Certainly, our awareness has been heightened, but we had put in extra cameras, extra panic buttons, the ability to lock down different zones of the hospital over the last couple of years, and we will continue to relook at our environment and see how we can keep our people safe.
You know, and Cindy, I'm just curious, you know, for people who work in emergency departments, has there been an assumption that unsafe situations will arise and that's just kind of the nature of working in that environment?
Absolutely. And, you know, it used to be I've been an ER nurse for over 20 years, and it was just considered part of the job to take abuse and verbal abuse and physical abuse from patients because that's just the way it was, and that is certainly not tolerated anymore. I think our culture is now that we will not accommodate people that are unreasonable, that are abusive to us. We were not, like, zero tolerance policy is in effect right now. And I think that's the stance we have to take, that it is not part of our job and we do not deserve to be treated like this.
Yeah, Chuck, in the Delnor situation, you know, as mentioned, the patient was an inmate who had been unshackled and then came into possession of a gun from one of the officers who was with him. What would happen at Carl, for instance, if someone who's not a prison inmate, someone just walks into the emergency room and they happen to be armed? What's the procedure there?
Well, if they're armed and they're displaying their weapon, you know, and that there becomes an active shooter situation, we have a policy in place which is, you know, run, hide, fight. That's code silver policy, run, hide, fight. So if you know, someone comes in as an active shooter, you know, we train our staff, if they can evacuate and run and get out of the area, then that's what they need to do. Research has shown that saves lives. If they're unable to run, then they're going to need to hide, you know, which, you know, go into an office, turn off the lights, lock the door, barricade yourself in. And of course, the last resort, you know, is fight. And, you know, that's kind of a daunting task, you know, for an armed person to take. But research has shown that you know, your chances for survival go up if you were to do that. Not much, but they do go up.
Okay. Before we say goodbye here, Hannah, I'm curious if you could just kind of bring us up to speed on the timeline here. Where is this lawsuit right now? Where is it at in court? And when are we expecting some sort of resolution in this case?
Well, so it's been filed in federal court, and there's really not a lot going on with it right now. All of the attorneys for each of the defendants, which include the sheriff's office, one of its corrections officers, specifically the one whose gun was stolen, and a private security company who was contracted by the hospital. Those are all three parties named in it, and they've all entered appearances. And so at this point, it's really just waiting. The judge has given all the defendants until July 21st to either answer or enter some other kind of motion or otherwise plead in some way to the plaintiff's complaint. So until then, we won't really know. That's when, I guess, we'll hear hopefully first from, you know, the sheriff's office. And there's also a status hearing scheduled for July 25th.
Okay, very good. We'll have to leave that there for now. But Hannah Leone, crime reporter with the Aurora Beacon News, Chuck Plotner, security director at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana, and Cindy Wrench, service line director with emergency medicine and urgent care services from Edward Hospital in Naperville. Thanks all three of you for being with us today on the 21st.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline. City leaders in Chicago have wanted a high-speed train going from O'Hare Airport to downtown Chicago for a long time. Now, Mayor Rahm Emanuel could be enlisting SpaceX founder Elon Musk to lend a hand. The Chicago Tribune says that Mayor Emanuel plans to bring people from Elon Musk's team to look at what it could take to connect downtown Chicago with one of the world's busiest airports. We're now joined by P.S. Sriaj, director of the Urban Transportation Center and research associate professor of the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Sriaj, welcome to the 21st.
Morning, Brian.
As we were saying, then Mayor Daley has wanted something like this since back in the 1990s. What would it actually take to build a high-speed rail from O'Hare to downtown Chicago?
In no particular order, I would say a lot of political will, political capital, real capital, and a buy-in from the traveling public, including important stakeholders from the city and around the country.
And Sriraj, what are the benefits and possible costs to a high-speed rail project like this one?
Train has always proven to impact urban form in a very, very positive and strong manner, as has been evidenced in Chicago with the various metro lines around the city and connecting the suburbs, where you have seen development take place in and around the urban areas, mainly due to the rail lines. So it is a very strong influence on urban development. And so there are benefits to be had because of rail lines being in place, be it above ground, underground, or on surface. And then there are the benefits can be categorized in many different ways. Whichever way you want to look at it, it can be a pure, straight benefit-cost analysis where you measure the benefits against the cost in terms of dollar values. There are also benefits to be had for society at large, which is rather the more challenging thing to do in terms of how to categorize and quantify those benefits accruing to society. And then there are economic impacts that arise from any investment in rail, and those also need to be looked at. And so it's a rather complex question to answer, but there are definitely benefits to be had all around. It's just a question of how do you go about listing them and compiling them to showcase that you are getting maximum returns for your investment.
Sure. And Sriraj, who would this project be built for? Who would likely use this the most?
Well, depends on various things. The most important thing being the cost, the price point at which such a service will be available. Looking at examples from around the world, there have been many successful examples of airport express trains from Hong Kong to London to even our near north neighbors. Toronto has a express train. And if you are targeting it for the daily commuters, then your price has to be tailored accordingly. If you're targeting business travelers, then you have a little bit more luxury in terms of where you want to tip that price point, and with the hope that it can be leveraged to bring more business and business travel to the city, which is always a good thing for everyone concerned. And then also the question that I will turn it back to you is, who's the target audience? So it has to be very clear on the minds of the policymakers and the decision makers in terms of who is it that they are trying to cater to. Of course, if you can put a service in place and then it can be tailored according to the needs. It can have differential pricing depending upon time of day. And there are various options you can tinker with. But the primary goal should be very clear when you go into such an exercise. Is it targeted for the business travelers? Is it for everyone that is currently benefiting from the CTA service? And then what happens to the CTA Blue Line service? So those are all the questions that needs to be answered. Of course, a lot of this really depends on the alignment of any new rail line. How many stations is it going to have? Is it a nonstop service from O'Hare to downtown Chicago? Too many unknowns at this point in time.
Sure. We just have about a minute left here, Sriraj. But whenever Elon Musk says he might build something, certainly politicians and the news media jump all over it. What are your thoughts on the role of the private sector and the tech industry in helping to build public infrastructure?
It's most welcome. It's about it's a very welcome gesture on the part of the private sector, because that's where that marriage needs to happen in order for large-scale public infrastructures to really take off the ground, so to speak, because of the sheer amount of investment that is needed, the capital that is needed, especially in a time where you have significant issues with respect to raising public capital. And we have significant issues with the existing infrastructure that we already have in Chicago. So any new initiative that can bring in private sector capital is always welcome.
P.S. Sriraj, Director of the Urban Transportation Center and Research Associate Professor of the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Brian, thank you for having me.
You're quite welcome. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecelio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thank you so much for listening.